and welcome back to the podcast. If you're new here, I'm Sheen, your host, and this episode is a very special one. It's part of our new series called Building Wealth for Women, brought to you by Pepperstone. And today, we have a returning guest by really, really popular demand. Please join me in welcoming Mehreen Khan, the economics editor of The Times. Wait, I want to add one more thing. And the podcast host of Heroes and Humans Football of podcast. Football.
Yeah, come on.
See, I knew it. So, hello, Mehreen, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
How does it feel to be back?
This is the three-peat. This is my third time.
First time was audio. You were in Brussels.
OG, yeah.
Second time in Dubai.
Yep.
Third time in London.
Yeah, and now, you know, you've made it, so... I'm glad I still get the call to come on, to be honest.
Of course you do. All right, tell us a little bit for the people who are listening to you for the first time. Give us a brief intro.
I'm a journalist in a mainstream legacy media way. So I write for a newspaper called The Times, based in London. I think it's a very old newspaper. It's older than New York Times, the OG Times, the paper of record in the UK. And I write about economics. So that's a very broad topic that encompasses things that people probably think economics is about. So money, sometimes financial markets, sometimes things like growth, government policy, inflation, more and more, where interest rates are going, all that kind of stuff. I try and spend a lot of time thinking about how they all piece together and sort of explain it for a general readership and anyone who's sort of interested in what is becoming, I think, much more of a heavily political topic. So when I took up this job in 2022, it was sort of the height of the energy crisis in most countries. A lot of people paying more bills. They're facing inflation for the first time sometimes in their lives. And now I think economics has become probably the singularly most important driver of people's election choices, their choice of government, but also where they want to put their money, how they see the world. So it's a super, super interesting job.
I know. And you know what's interesting is because you are in traditional media. And when we did the podcast, the way people loved the way you delivered things, it means that you translate so well into the new form of media, which is podcasting, social media, and you don't have social media.
I don't really have social media, right? Actually. So I used to be one of the people that used Twitter a lot, like a lot of journalists, as a very good source of information flow. And to, especially if you're interested in, you know, during the financial crisis, you know, there would be lots of specialists that were using Twitter to tell you what was going on in a particular area of the banking system. So it was a really, really useful platform. And I built my, you know, early journalistic career using Twitter. And now that's sort of, I mean, I just don't use it as much anymore. It still is a little bit useful, but the algorithm has changed. And I just haven't found a social media that really fits with the kind of thing that I like doing on social media, which is lurking a little bit and watching and trying to absorb a lot of other people's conversations and then sort of chipping in when I think I've got something to say. So, you know, Blue Sky is super, I mean, it's a completely different world. I would say it's a very liberal platform. So if you go on Twitter and then you go on Blue Sky and you read about the same topics, you'll get a completely parallel political realities. And so I don't think it's reached a critical mass yet. Instagram I did have, and then too many people started following me because they thought I would use it, so I had to get rid of it. So once I hit 2,000 followers, I was like, this is way too many. This is not what I'm here for. I'm lurking. So I got rid of it on January the 1st. And, you know, LinkedIn is pretty cringe. And I, you know, I have yet to launch a Twitch stream or a...
Snapchat,
yeah. I'm thinking about 25 years too old for that. No Snapchat. So, but I do have my own podcast. So technically, maybe I am breaking into the new media, but doing something completely different, which is talking about something completely non-related. Although sometimes if you listen to our episodes cleverly, if you listen to our episodes closely enough, you might hear some economics from me, but mostly it's just about football.
Amazing. Okay, so we're talking about building wealth for women specifically. And the reason I wanted to speak to you about this is because I feel like you're the one who's taught me a lot about finances in general and sometimes geography, but mostly finances.
There is a strong intersection between those two things for you.
Strong intersection.
Yeah.
My first question is, we talked about this briefly last time. What's the difference between trying to become rich and building wealth?
So I think that distinction has become blurred for a lot of younger people where, so in a classical sense of like why income is different to wealth, So if we're talking about it in super boring kind of political terms or political economy terms, they're different because they're taxed differently by usually by your government. So most people who have a job or earn any form of income are taxed at a particular tax rate, which is clearly defined, and everyone sort of knows what tax bracket they're in. Or if they're in Dubai, you know, none close to zero, right?
Yeah.
And then wealth is different. Wealth is things that people sort of thought about as things you can inherit. Homes, assets, more tangibility around it. So maybe a stock of wealth versus a flow of income. So the money that you make every month is your income, and the wealth is the stuff that you've accumulated over time or things you're investing in as a nest, a safety pot. Your pension is part of your wealth, and they are taxed differently. So there's always been a distinction between those two things from a really boring kind of personal finance sort of way, how you think about them. You know, you can be an asset rich person, but somebody who doesn't have much income. Mm-hmm. And I think now wealth is very much associated with actually being rich.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that connection always existed. And because, you know, more assets you accumulate, that is a very good, heavy sign of wealth. And that wealth, if those assets are liquid, can ultimately return you money.
Mm.
And now I think being rich seems to be something that people aspire to from a young age, because they see money and they see money all around them, and they see the results of money, and they see money as a not just a literal form of, you know, transaction, but a social currency, and it gets you into certain places and you strive for it. And it doesn't necessarily come through conventional forms, like you go to university and then you get a good job, which was just a standard issue, you know, second, third generation migrant path to becoming a successful person. So I think now we've moved into a world where the wealth in and of itself, the asset classes, are associated with a certain type of being rich. So like crypto is one area where I think people very clearly think that they use crypto or invest in crypto to build their wealth. And that wealth also translates into a what they would see as a, you know, a clear value. The thing goes up and down, and depending on that you can determine how rich you are as a result of it. So I think a lot of these terms around what people feel about wealth and income and how wealthy they are have all sort of become very blurred in a world where people can make a lot of money on the internet. Lots of people invest. They think they need to invest. Mm-hmm. There are different types of asset classes out there for them. And I think there is more an emphasis now on getting rich than really building wealth. So there's a short-termism about the idea that, you know, if I basically bought Bitcoin back in 2007, I would be very rich right now.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be a wealthy person? Yeah, but by some metric, sure, because you could be in the, you could have a net worth based on millions. And I think even that term net worth is something that people use much more. Like I see 21-year-olds thinking about their net worth. And it's just, you know, something at even my ripe age, which I'm not going to reveal, I rarely ever think about myself. So there just seems to be much more of a zeitgeist around getting money through different non-conventional forms, and seeing being wealthy and rich as the same sort of thing. And I think that is a difference from how it's traditionally been seen.
Yeah, and I think now that you've mentioned it, right, if you think about it, even I go back to social media, is because we all see these crypto bros living their best lives, the private jet life, and they sit in their private jet telling you, you are wasting your time working, you can become quick, rich, and all of that. And then you see, again, like property, and people tell you about their portfolio, and young people get really confused, right? And I think especially women, when we talk about investing, a lot of women are still sitting on their pot of money and not doing anything about it. They probably do want to make money, but I think the main problem is education and access, right? So what do you think really is the thing that's stopping women from building wealth?
I think it is, there's probably a lot of factors, but I will just talk about things that I think anecdotally are true. I think one, generally the finance space, and if we're definitely talking about digital assets, it's a very bro space, right? It's dominated by men, often younger men, often sort of a certain kind of archetype for a man, you know, the kind of hustle culture, make your money work for you, passive income, drop shippers, you know, these are all, if I'm just thinking about where I have been exposed to these sorts of things, it's from men who have platforms in which they tell people this is a good way to build income. I can't even think of a woman I sort of know in that particular space on the internet. So I think that already creates a degree of distance, because you think it's for teenage boys sitting in their bedroom trying to work out which is the best product to get rich drop shipping on. And then, you know, going from there and then investing that money in a crypto thing and then joining someone's Discord and then being part of this. And, you know, this is all the kind of Nelk boys, Andrew Tate kind of, you know, Lamborghinis world. Mm-hmm. We're all very familiar with it. And there is very few women that seem to be in any way part of this discourse. Now, I don't know, because there's very little data about whether women are actually trying these schemes for themselves, or if it's just too much of an intimidating environment. And I would compare it actually in a more traditional sense to how I felt about economics. So I write about economics, but I have never studied economics. Mm-hmm. I've never even studied finance. I learned how to do economics journalism by being in newspapers and seeing and reading, you know, seeing other journalists do it and reading a lot. And economics on the internet, sort of the discourse around economics, is also very male. It's dominated by male academics, dudes in finance, hedge fund managers, mm-hmm. male commentators, often male journalists. And I remember when I got into this job, I was like, you know, it's, if you know, there'll always be that guy on the internet that if you didn't use percentage point instead of percent or basis point instead of blah, blah, that will just come after you, right? Mm-hmm. And it's an intimidating space, because if people are seeing what you're putting out into the world, they will be judging you. And there's always a sense in which, as a woman, you don't really know what you're doing. So I think economics, finance and investing is just it's from the outside, it just feels like quite an intimidating place, because we don't really have the female voices that are doing the equivalent of what, I'll be honest, what, you know, sort of what Andrew Tate did to people in terms of thinking about how they should build up, like not go to university or find different forms of education, or what a lot of the crypto enthusiasts, the founders of whom mostly of a lot of coins are men too. Mm-hmm. So that is a barrier. And so how do you overcome that? I mean, I would hope there are female creators in space. I think there are. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're probably operating at slightly lower levels in terms of visibility. But like anyone who wants to invest their money, you got to spend a reasonable amount of your own time, if you're not willing to basically give that job to someone else to manage your money, to do your research. And maybe if you can't get past the first couple of barriers because of your sort of interlocutors, you don't seem to feel that you have anything in common with them. I think that's a barrier.
Yeah, and I guess now with the age of ChatGPT and stuff, you could always learn. Anything can be learned for free online now.
Yes, in a gender-neutral way.
Yeah, very gender-neutral way. And I think that that has helped a lot of people to start the journey of learning and understanding. But what else do you reckon, obviously based on your world of where you are in terms of how, let's take, for example, the fact that Trump is back in power. He's already impacted a lot of how things are doing in the stock market. What do you foresee could be happening, and how can that impact especially women directly?
Quick break for a word from today's sponsor. Are you looking to turn global trends into trading opportunities? Meet Pepperstone, where top-tier trading tech meets competitive pricing. Trade forex, commodities, shares, and indices with ultra-low spreads starting from zero on a Razor account. Fast execution? Check. 24/5 support? Check. Plus, you can trade on MetaTrader, CTrader, TradingView, and more. And don't worry, they're fully regulated by top financial authorities worldwide. So why wait? Trade smarter with Pepperstone today. There's a link in my bio for you to check it out, and a huge shout out to Pepperstone for supporting Building Wealth for Women through this podcast. Thank you.
So, I mean, we're recording at a time in, say, it's mid-February right yeah. now, but since, you know, I don't want to say since January 20th, since the US election, the kind of global markets in most asset classes have been gripped by volatility. Mm. And volatility sounds bad. What it just means is the price of stuff is moving at extreme paces. So, you know, we saw this with the US stock market, which was booming after the election. We're now speaking at a time where a lot of that money is, well, a lot of money is cooling on US stocks because of things happening in China with Chinese AI, because of Trump's policies towards trading partners. So tariffs, whether he's serious, whether he's not serious. One day he says, I'm going to do the tariff. Then he says, I'm not going to do the tariff. All of this uncertainty creates volatility in the market. And it means that if you have a portfolio that you just see on your phone or in your app, that maybe you only own a couple of stocks, say, let's say, their price can move very quickly day from day. And that's quite scary if indeed you're the sort of person who checks it every day. And I imagine most people check their portfolios multiple times a day. Mm. And if they're always moving, you're going to think, I just need to get rid of this. Or where's this going to be going in a couple of weeks' time? Am I going to lose all my money? And you're not I mean, I'd be a fool to tell you I knew what was driving the market on any given day.
Yeah.
But it's all the kind of noise about the things that we've just explained. So mm-hmm. uncertainty about US policy, the state of different types of economies, the US versus China, potentially an end to the war in Ukraine, an amicable end, a not amicable end. Who's going to be agreeing to the deal? We had a ceasefire in Israel mm-hmm. And Gaza, but the future for Palestinians looks very uncertain. It's causing other people in the region to be very upset at the US region. I mean, there's a lot of unknowns. So I think that, again, is probably not just a barrier. I think that's a barrier in general, but I would imagine that if you're somebody that's less experienced in trading or even understanding financial markets, you would think this is not exactly the time I want to dip my toe into the market because everything seems to be in flux. Mm. And I think that is a correct assessment. So we're at a very particularly, I would say particularly unique moment. I can't really remember anything like this in terms of people just having low conviction on everything that they're trading right now. But we can talk about maybe some things that people think are much more of sure bets. And that is going to put off the average retail investor. Unless your risk appetite is kind of super high and you enjoy this stuff and you're such an experienced person in the market, the volatility is actually the way that you try and make money. But those kind of people work for hedge funds and investment banks. That's not sort of average sort of consumer that I think, you know, who wants to just get there, you know, has some disposable income and thinks, where shall I park my money? If you're making that judgment right now, I imagine this is probably one of the sort of times you're going to think, let me ride this out and wait until things stabilize. And I think the problem with that is that we don't know when that point will come, because for now it looks like the volatility is very much here to stay.
You mentioned risk appetite, and I think that comes up a lot. For example, we were with Pepperstone interviewing F1 Academy drivers last week, and the risk appetite of women came up again, being like, this is one of the main reasons why we don't have a female F1 driver yet, because we are engineered to be less risk driven, right? And I think that probably plays a big role into why women are not really in the forefront of investing. How did you bypass that, or how do you think we can bypass that?
It's actually a really good analogy. I was actually just yesterday speaking to someone who is a female friend of mine who trades, and I actually used this exact analogy with her of the F1 driver. Because F1 drivers, you know, they're not wired like the rest of us, because they're in a car and they're going 200 miles an hour and they see a corner and they go 200 miles through the corner, which is sort of overriding all of your natural instincts in your brain, which basically tells you to put the foot on your brakes. Mm-hmm. And it's a very good analogy to risk appetite. Some people can put on a lot of money on a big bet because they see the corner and they're going at 200 and they stay at 200. Whereas most of us will now open up our apps and see what's going on in the news and think, okay, I'm going to put my foot on the brakes, right? I'm either going to sell, or the volumes that I'm trying to invest, I'm going to drastically cut them back. Or you could do the other thing, which is just switch your phone off and then come back in 6 months' time. But I think that's very difficult for people to do unless you are, again, wired in a completely different way. So there is, and I think it's based basically in a lot of behavioral science, and I think a lot of strong empirics about female risk appetite. And the way that we're talking about it now, or the way that people talk about it in finance, we think of it as a bad thing, right? Because if you're putting big bets on and those big bets cash out, you can make a lot of money. And people are making a lot of money. I think the whole story around crypto in the last 18 months, from its lows to where it's gone now, is that if you could stomach the lows and you rode out the bad times, you're getting rewarded now. And risk appetite is, I wouldn't say it's low in women. It's a different calculation. It's about winning and also losing, of course. That's the whole balance of the risk appetite. But it's interesting because now we're living at a time where I think people, you know, see the stock market as a way that they should be getting in on this opportunity. But I grew up, or I became a financial journalist because I lived in the during the era of the financial crisis, right? That's why I'm a financial journalist, because I saw this seismic event happening in my country, the UK, and also most developed world countries. You know, banks were collapsing, states were bailing out these financial institutions. It was such a scarring event. And at that particular juncture in time, risk appetite was seen as a complete liability, because these guys in the financial system, mainly bankers, were taking too much risk. They were mispricing assets and they were making big bets on things that went wrong. And when they went wrong, we had to bail them out. And so there was actually this whole movement, and it was spoken about a lot, and it's sort of disappeared, is that if we had more women in finance, or we had more women running financial institutions and trading, they wouldn't have got into that kind of mess. So the neatest way this has been put is by Christine Lagarde, who used to be the French finance minister, and said, if Lehman Brothers, the bank that, you know, the poster child, sadly, of the financial crisis, which went bust, if Lehman Brothers was called Lehman Sisters, then we wouldn't have ever got into this mess. Right? So that's quite, I mean, it's quite telling. It's a pretty powerful quip to say that it was men and their outrageous risk appetite that got us, that sent the world to hell in a handcart, right? It was a very, very difficult time for people. People lost their jobs, they lost their homes, there were foreclosures. The taxpayer had to spend hundreds of billions of pounds bailing these people out. And then we had to suffer because governments then had to rein in their belts and sort of do austerity to pay for that, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was just over a decade ago. That was nearly two decades ago. Sorry, now I am old. That was around 2008-09, where we spoke about female risk appetite or their ability to be more balanced about risk as something that could have saved the world from disaster. And now we're in, I think the cycle has turned again. Now we're in a world where we all want to take opportunities because Trump is going to, you know, overheat the US economy and he's going to unleash tax cuts and capitalism is going to be on steroids and we all want a part of it. We need more risk appetite. And the sort of balance that maybe a woman would bring to the job is seen as like, you know, you need to kind of get over your risk problems, right? You need to be a bit more daring. So we have moved very quickly. The cycle has moved very quickly. And the other thing I would note is that there now are just more women around in finance, actually. That did happen after the financial crisis. So in the UK, we have our first ever female finance minister. We've never had a female finance minister before. We have had a female prime minister. Christine Lagarde is now running the European Central Bank. The former head of the US Treasury that's left with the Biden administration was a woman. The deputy prime minister of Canada and finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, who just left the government, was a woman. So there are more women in senior financial positions. And if the Lehman sister thing is right, that should be a better way to help regulate these sort of people. And it should mean we don't get into the kind of messes that we got into during the 2008-2009 crisis. So I would just say that there's always a flip side to this idea that women don't take risk. Because when we get into when that risk gets us into a lot of trouble, suddenly we think, oh, we should have just had more women around.
Just have it a bit more careful.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, taking another industry for this, it's also the startup world. So, you know, when founders are raising money, or out of all like the global money that goes to startup founders, I think only like less than 1% goes to female founders.
Wow.
But the statistics show that a female founder is 3 times more likely to be successful than a male founder and actually returning the money's worth to the investors because of the way they approach risk.
Right.
Right? Because men just take risk and then they're like, well, all the money's gone now. It wasn't successful. But again, I think more and more, so this statistics with the startup world is always very depressing because when you think about it, female founders are struggling to raise money and they are the ones that could potentially do good. So then, I don't know, it all looks bleak right now when we talk about it, but what is the upside?
I mean, I guess that's a structural issue is in the people doing the funding themselves are more likely to be men.
Yes.
I'm assuming.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like the average job interview. You see yourself in this person. There is a certain degree of like testosterone that is like attached to the idea of, you know, as the founder, I guess you have to sell the vision of your company.
Right.
And you sell a big vision and you sell the whole dream to an investor guy that also wants to make a lot. He wants to make sure that you're the bet that comes in, right? You're the cash cow, that you could be the next Alibaba, let's say, you know, if we're going to use like the Masayoshi-san, Jack Ma analogy, that you're the bet that comes good. And to do that, you have to have a certain degree of bravado about you, a certain degree of hyperbole about you. You have to sell the dream. And I imagine, you know, it'd be more likely that a woman is less likely to kind of do a lot of the embellishment with the business plan or with the 5-year plan or how quickly they want to grow. And they give you something that looks slightly more sensible, but maybe it's a bit less attractive or sexy and there's less risk involved. And that's why, you know, this was always described to me in a way when I remember doing my exams and my tutor told me that, look, at this university, the men either fail or they do really, really well. So you either get a first or you get a third. And all the women are sort of around the 2-1 area, right? Because you guys have all done your reading and you're all producing very good nuanced essays, but sometimes you struggle with argumentation, so you don't have a clear line and you're not provocative enough to get the top, but you're not going to be so bad that you haven't done any reading, so you'll actually fail the degree. And he always told me to think more like a man. And so you know, I'm not, I think it's quite problematic to get around the structural issue by telling women to behave or to adopt male mores. You would hope, and I don't know that much about the VC world, that there is a way for women to sell themselves and to sell their businesses in a way that doesn't mean that they have to ape the male sort of mannerisms and the way of speaking and, and selling people the dream. I think that is happening, probably. Maybe it doesn't go noticed as much. Mm-hmm. But so, for example, in my kind of job, like, you know, I write about economics in probably a very different way because of my generation, probably because I'm the first woman to have ever had this job at my newspaper. So,
wow.
So I think incremental steps. So I'm probably not as bleak. I think change will happen, and it probably is. But the structural issues, you know, there's always a trade-off between, well, do you just do what my tutor said and just be more like a dude?
Mm-hmm.
Or can you find a way to be successful that doesn't really require you sort of cosplaying as a man?
Mm. Well, if we were to expand this a little bit, right, of course, you mentioned that you were the first woman to do this role. And we're looking at the VC world, we're looking at the financial institutions as well. But if you were to think more globally, there's that statistics as well that came out that said that, you know, women only apply for a job if they tick 80% of the boxes, but men will apply even if they tick like 10% of the boxes. Yeah. And they will sell themselves like they tick 100%. And they've done that many times. And it goes to show that women are so humble about their achievement. And that's one issue I had as well when I was applying for jobs, is that Even till date, the feedback I get is that you're too humble. I didn't know that's what you've achieved. And I think that's a problem that women face across the board. So how did you thrive? I mean, I just use the word, you know, 2025, 2020, thrive. I know you love that. So how did you thrive in this environment where a lot of the times you were the youngest one, you were the only woman one?
I think, so I actually started off in sports journalism. And so,
again, crazy.
Yeah, but that was what I wanted to do. The way that I got into a newsroom for the first time was because I was on the sports desk, and that's what I wanted to do. And I very quickly learned that it didn't really matter how good I was at this job. I'd probably never really ascend to a certain level, or people would always just assume that I'm there because I'm a DEI hire or something. Because women, now it's changed a lot, but women on sports desk, or being especially football reporters, it was a relatively like novel, rare feature of like mainstream UK press. And I actually quit. So I basically was like, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to try and do a different type of journalism where my gender, my age would be less, I think, of a factor for other people judging the way that I do the job. And I stumbled onto finance, and I don't want to like overhype how sort of meritocratic it is to be a financial journalist, but ultimately if you get it, sort of understand the concepts and you're able to write about them well and communicate them quite clearly, you're doing really well as a financial journalist. The financial journalism is a bizarre sort of journalism. Most journalism is writing about people and tangible characters. Financial journalism is about writing about abstract things like inflation, which you can't see, but we can all feel.
Mm.
Unemployment, a concept that people only see whether they have a job or not, but to, you know, these big abstractions. Economic growth, what the hell does it mean? Right, a lot of terms, a lot of obfuscation, sometimes deliberately used by the economics community. And to do that, you have to, you know, you really just have to try and strip things down to the basics. So I think in that sense, financial journalism was the part of the journalistic world that I felt that as a young woman, if I can do this well, people will be able to recognize that I am good at this. And in sports journalism, I didn't feel that because I felt like my gender would always be a factor in this heavily, heavily dominated world, male dominated world. So I think finance and sport are two very male dominated areas. And they are the two that I sort of work in. If we think about the podcast as sort of a return to sports journalism for me, but with the sport, it was just really difficult to convince any bloke that I really knew what I was talking about.
Mm.
And in economics, that there's a certain degree of progress that has been made that you can be somebody that could, you know, be in the financial world, and you will get, I wouldn't say respect, but there is a sense in which maybe you do deserve to be there. And I did it through a lot of hard work and a lot of diligence and, you know, doing that thing that a lot of perhaps women in male-dominated industries do, which is like, can't make any mistakes and I can't slip up. Mm-hmm. 'Cause as soon as I do, then that's a way for people to discredit me and I won't be able to get back on that horse again. Mm-hmm. It's kind of no second chances in this business. So you've got to be the most accurate, the clearest, you know, make sure that your sources are the top ones, make sure you've triple sourced everything, that you're the most accurate with your use of numbers, that you've never forgot, you know, mistaken million for billion, which is the sort of things that can get financial journalists sacked on the spot, or moving, you know, not having a decimal place in the right place, things like this, to kind of be hyper vigilant about it. And I mean, this is just a lot of luck that has been involved in my career and my ability to do different types of jobs. So I write about economics now, but I sort of had a different sort of job writing about sort of politics and Europe a few years before that, and I've written a little bit about financial markets. So, you know, I'm not going to sell girls the dream that one, journalism in and of itself is an industry that they should be, that is a sustainable, you know, future-proof industry, very much not so, and that even financial journalism is some kind of safe haven. But from my colleagues and looking at sort of the business desk where I work and other female journalists, there are a lot of us in financial journalism, because there just has been that ability to, maybe unlike maybe political journalism or more traditionally male sports journalism, that you can do well as long as you've got the fundamentals right. Mm-hmm. But again, big structural issues exist with women getting out of work, women having children, women getting promoted. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm probably one of the most senior people at the Times as a woman, and that's not a great place to be. I wouldn't necessarily want to be in that position. I would hope that there was a complete string of senior right. management who were yeah. women, and they're not, which tells you that something has gone wrong somewhere.
But that means that you get to now be that for the younger generation.
Apparently, yes.
That's Which cool.
It was quite a responsibility. But yeah, I mean, I'm very honest with a lot of younger journalists about what they want from this industry. All of them do actually have social media and they understand the power of social media. And they will realize that podcasts get more eyeballs than CNN these days. And you saw that with multiple election campaigns, and TikTok pages get read more than the Financial Times, et cetera, et cetera. And personal finance pages about crypto or gold or where to put your money are doing better than, you know, are basically cutting out a lot of the middlemen in the financial services industry or the funds industry, which has mm-hmm. traditionally been where people go and park their money with a fund manager who invests it for them. And now people think, no, I can just do it by myself because I've got an app on my phone, and, you know, and they can.
Yeah.
And they really, really can. So this entire kind of traditional media and traditional finance industry has been, you know, usurped by the growth of digital assets. And I would say the heightened awareness of trading and markets among people. I wouldn't say that they're more literate. Mm-hmm. I think it'd be hard to say that's the case, because I still think that the literacy gap is one that is not really... I wouldn't say that people, just because they are able to trade more, now understand really the dynamics and the fundamentals of what they're trading. Mm. I think they trade on vibes, huh? But one could say that all markets have always traded on vibes.
Exactly.
Forever and ever, so.
And it's always about who's doing it as well, right? Yes. So then it's following the trend. Yes. So then that
the
impacts
crowds,
everything.
The crowds, the herds, momentum.
Yeah. Always.
These exist on a retail level as much as they exist on an institutional level.
But, you know, speaking of trends as well, there's a lot of talks about gold now, especially where I'm from in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Gold has always been something that people invest their money in.
Yes.
Based on, you know, how like the geopolitics are going, do you reckon gold is something that's going to come back?
So it's back.
It's back already.
It's kind of back. So I wrote a column, if anyone wants to check it out, about a few months ago about why I'd basically changed my mind on gold. Mm. So, gold has been around longer than we've had coinage and traditional forms of money. And both, you know, I'm South Asian, mm-hmm. you're Mauritian, you mm-hmm. understand that gold plays a very big part in our cultures yeah. As a form of beauty and embellishment, but also as a form of store of wealth mm-hmm. for women. Mm-hmm. Right, specifically for women, especially in an Islamic context of why gold is important. And so when I sort of got into financial journalism, you'd have these people called gold bugs, and they were always people that were predicting the collapse of the financial system. They always thought we're 1 year away from hyperinflation, where your money's going to be worth nothing, and that's why you need gold. And I was like, these guys, I mean, like, they're like cranks. Huh? I dismiss these people as cranks. And something has changed in the world. And I would say it's changed in the era of inflation. So gold has traditionally always been a hedge against inflation. So when we have times of high inflation, your money is worth less in the future. Mm-hmm. So the $1 I have in 2025, if we have inflation running at 2%, in a couple of years, that $1 is depreciates in value. Yeah. That's how inflation works. It erodes the real value of your money. Now, gold has always been a hedge against that because gold is gold. It's a big lump of shiny metal. You can do some stuff with it, like make jewelry, but you can't really do that much with it. And there's a finite amount of it in the earth. There's never really going to be more. We could discover a few more gold mines somewhere, mm-hmm. but ultimately we know the amount of the stock of gold in the world. And so that's the way, and it doesn't depreciate in a sense. It's a commodity, so its price changes. Mm-hmm. And since 2022, I would say, so the era of inflation in most rich world economies, and something really important happened with Russia, which is that they were put under huge financial sanctions led by the US and European countries. The price of gold has been hitting record highs now almost on a monthly basis. So two things are happening. One is the classic inflation thing that always happens every time we have inflation, gold goes up. Mm-hmm. And this other thing about Russia, which was that Russia was put under financial sanctions, which was an attempt to cut Russia off from the financial system. So the dollarized financial system as a way to punish Putin for the war. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other central banks in a lot of other countries thought, okay, the US can hit you with sanctions that will literally freeze financial assets in your central bank, stop people transacting with you in the world's reserve currency. Mm-hmm. That could happen to us. Mm-hmm. So the Chinese are like, that could happen to us. Central Asian countries are like, that can happen to us. Countries in Africa are like, that can happen to us. So what do you do in that situation? And a lot of their central banks, so the institutions that sort of control the money supply and interest rates in those countries, started buying a lot of gold to put in their vaults. Just to hold it as the ultra safe form of a hedge against financial sanctions. So now you're seeing not just people buying gold, as we've always done, but massive, massive monetary institutions buying it, which is why the price of gold has gone up and looks like it basically has no ceiling anymore, right? So this fear about financial policy in the US is not going to be reduced under Trump. If anything, he makes the whole question about whether he's going to punish you for whatever you may have done, you know, bought too much, sold too much to the US or have a too high of a trade balance or something else he doesn't like being Greenland. I don't know. And so the gold thing is taken on a different dynamic. And that's why I changed my mind about it, because I always thought gold bugs were these guys who just thought hyperinflation is around the corner. But now gold is a super important asset in our very complicated geopolitics by protecting some countries, very powerful countries, from the omnipotent presence of the US dollar, which is what our modern financial system is run on. So that's why I think that, you know, when, you know, I was a little girl and my grandma wanted to buy me gold jewelry, I was like, I don't even like gold. It doesn't suit me.
Yeah.
I was like, should have taken the necklace.
So yellow. You know? And now,
I've massively regret it. Yeah. Any of my distant relatives out there want to buy me some gold jewelry, I'm all in.
It's all welcome. Valentine's Day is coming up.
So maybe, you know, you said you live in the Middle East. Human beings since the beginning of time have always seen the intrinsic value of gold because it's shiny and it does something to our brain chemistry. And now, if you're a country, big or small, worried about, you know, incredible financial punishments that could be meted on you by the world's global superpower, buy gold. So, like, in some ways, it's just a very primal response. And so I changed my mind on it because I sort of realized that this is a much more telling proxy for how uncertain the world has become, mm-hmm. the gold price.
Amazing. And to wrap it all up, other than buy gold...
Buy gold. This is not financial advice.
Of course.
Take gold from your relatives if they're offering it to you. Don't say no. Yeah.
Yeah.
To all my women out there, brown or white.
And now Valentine's Day is coming up. So, you know.
Yeah.
Gold time. What advice do you have for women when it comes to building wealth in general?
I think, let's go back to the Lehman Sisters analogy. I think use whatever inhibitions you think you might have towards risk to your advantage. Right now, we're living in a world where, as I said, there's a huge amount of volatility and people with high risk appetite are losing a lot of money in this kind of world. And I think it would be a shame if a lot of women who thought, well, 2025 was the year that I want to go, you know, I've got a little pot of money saved up, I don't need it, this is money that I wanted to invest, that they think it's too much of a scary time to do it. Take your time, think about what's right for you. If you want to invest in gold, you know, like... You know, don't think that there's a correct form of investing or there is a certain asset class that you need to hold. If you understand stocks because they're easier to understand and you understand how companies operate more than you say understand how debt markets operate, you know, fixed income, it's a bit more of a difficult world to understand. Do what feels easiest and always, always start small and understand that the money that you're putting at risk is money that you can afford to lose. But I think women kind of beat themselves up about this idea that we're risk averse. And I think we're now moving into a world where, as I said, like if we went full cycle from the financial crisis to then this era of like, we need to have more risk, that pendulum will swing back. And I think if you are that sort of person that is in the middle, when it does swing back, then you hopefully should be, you know, in a better position than a lot of your peers who might have been, you know, a bit more sort of gung-ho about where to put their money, like in, you know, certain cryptocurrencies mm-hmm. or things that just look hot because they're hot in the moment. Like NFTs is a great example of, yeah. you know, the hottest thing in the world for about 12 months. And everyone was like kind of buying
Should
in.
I do but it?
Yeah. yeah. Everyone was like, well, everyone's getting in. So maybe I need to buy that cartoon monkey. Mm. And we all sort of intrinsically knew that the cartoon monkey was never really more than a JPEG, as far as mm-hmm. I could tell. but people were paying hundreds and thousands and nearly millions of pounds for it. So use your instincts because they're probably correct. Mm-hmm. And just spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, the world. It's a very confusing place. And if you want to trust other people with your money, like, that's not a bad way mm-hmm. to sort of enter into the market. So I think women should be... I think we need to understand that we do have intrinsic qualities when it comes to what we, how we manage our money and where we, how we try to build wealth. And just because it may not be au fait right now in this hyper-Trumpian testosterone-y sort of world, doesn't mean that you're still not correct.
Amazing. Well, thank you once again, Mehreen, for being here. This was extremely educational for me as well. Now I've learned a lot more. But anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Yeah, be long yourself. That's my financial advice. Do you know what that means? It just means back yourself.
I was like, yeah. Did I even hear?
Yeah, go long. Go long on yourself.
Go long.
Go
okay.
long on yourself. Be long yourself.
Okay. Yeah.
Not belong, be long.
I
yeah, it's probably bad English, but yeah.
I understand. All right. I will be long.
Be long yourself.
Okay, yeah. Thank you, Mary.